Chapter 15, A Big Setback. On my return to Kalimpong and the Hermitage, one of the first things I did was to go to the octagonal shrine room at the end of the garden and pay my respects to the standing image of the Buddha which Lama Govinda had given me. There he stood, with his white sapphire sparkling in the middle of his forehead and his right hand raised in blessing, looking exactly as he had looked 3 weeks earlier. But though he looked the same as before, I knew that he was not, in fact, the same. A subtle change had taken place. During my absence in Nepal, he had been formally consecrated by a Tibetan incarnate lama. This incarnate lama was none other than the one who occupied the upstairs floor of the house in which Joe was living, and who, the latter had informed me with considerable satisfaction, was studying English with him. Oh, yes. Even though he had received no education to speak of and was only a humble upasaka, he was now the honoured teacher of a prominent member of the Tibetan Buddhist hierarchy. Nor was that all. The Rinpo Chi, as Joe insisted on calling the incarnate lama, deliberately mispronouncing the title so as to demonstrate his entire freedom from the taint of so-called cleverness, was a model student. Believe it or not, he actually came downstairs for his lessons instead of allowing him, the humble upasaka, to go upstairs. What could be more gracious and condescending than that, or more indicative of his respect for someone who, just because he wasn't clever, was generally looked down on? Moreover, the Rinpo Chi always carried his exercise books and writing materials himself. He wouldn't allow his attendant monk to carry them for him, and he wouldn't allow a humble upasaka to carry them either. At the end of the lesson, though, he always invited him upstairs for a cup of delicious Tibetan tea, which he drank in the Rinpo Chi's own private sitting room, surrounded by the most gorgeous images and tankards. All this Joe had told me some time before my departure for Nepal, and I had naturally formed a wish to meet Dalai Rinpoche, as the incarnate lama was called. On my mentioning the matter to Joe, however, the cantankerous upasaka waved his beringed hand in the air in his most dismissive manner. It was out of the question, he declared. The Rinpo Chi was very busy with his studies and meditations, as well as with the elaborate rituals which he was always being asked to perform, and it was extremely difficult to meet him. It was difficult even for Tibetans to meet him, especially as his old mother stood guard over him like a venerable dragon and turned away all those whose offerings were not, in her opinion, worthy of his acceptance. "You come here to see such a big lama," she would scold them, "yet you offer such a small offering. Be off with you, and don't come again unless you can do better." From the emphatic way in which he told me these things, it was obvious that Joe was not at all keen on my meeting Dalai Rinpoche, and that his attitude towards his distinguished pupil was, in fact, quite possessive. Nonetheless, I persisted, and after I had raised the matter with him two or three more times, he reluctantly agreed to inform the Rinpoche that I wanted to meet him, and, if possible, make arrangements for me to come up to Sherpa Building one day for this purpose. By the time of my departure for Nepal, however, these arrangements had still not been made, though Joe assured me that he had delivered my message, and that the Rinpo Chi had expressed his willingness to receive me. I therefore told him that one of the reasons for my wanting to meet Dalai Rinpoche was that I had intended inviting him to visit the hermitage and consecrate the standing image of the Buddha which Lama Govinda had given me. If the Rinpoche was agreeable, I added, I had no objection to this being done in my absence, since the sooner the image was consecrated the better. And in any case, it would be a good thing for YMBA activities not to come to a complete standstill while I was away. Thus it was that some 10 days before my return, Joe had brought Dalai Rinpoche down to the hermitage, where he'd been received with all due ceremony, and where, having been entertained to tea, he had consecrated Lama Govinda's image and blessed the shrine room, by chanting verses from the Tibetan scriptures and scattering grains of rice. Though not very largely attended, the function had by all accounts been a great success, the more especially since Dawa had been able to explain to the Rinpoche in Tibetan what the aims, objects and activities of the YMBA were. Indeed, on his being shown over the premises, the latter had evinced particular interest in the games room and the library and reading room, a fact that had delighted the regular users of those facilities. Dada Rinpoche was, it seemed, a very human kind of incarnate lama, and one who was by no means lacking in sympathy for the younger generation. As I heard all this from Lachiman and Dawa, both of whom were particularly enthusiastic about Dada Rinpoche's visit, I felt more sorry than ever that I had not been present and that I had not been able to meet the Rinpoche, especially as he had already left Kalimpong in order to take up an appointment in the same Gum monastery, which I had visited in the company of Lama Govinda and Li Gotami that autumn, and where I had seen the colossal figure of Maitreya silently dominating the other images. Dada Rinpoche and I were in fact not to make each other's acquaintance for well over a year, and when we did finally do so, it was thanks to the good offices of the young Tibetan in brown chuba and yellow sash, whom I had met at Marco Palace's bungalow. But though I was sorry that I had not been able to meet Dada Rinpoche, I was glad that he had been to the hermitage and consecrated Lama Govinda's image, and glad that in my absence the activities committee had shown some initiative and organised at least one successful function. Nonetheless, I knew very well that such initiative was exceptional, and that, partly on account of Joe's lack of enthusiasm for his duties as chairman, and partly on account of the inexperience of the other members, the activities committee was not functioning in the way that I had hoped it would. Obviously, something would have to be done about this. No less obviously, however, it would have to be done later rather than sooner, for my immediate task, now that I was back in Kalimpong, was to bring out the next issue of Stepping Stones, as well as to commit my impressions of Nepal to paper before they faded more than they had already done. The next issue of Stepping Stones was the November one. For some reason or other, I had not been able to bring it out before my departure for Nepal, so that instead of appearing at the beginning of the month, it appeared at the very end. This meant that as soon as I had sent out the November issue to press, I had to start putting the December one together, so that what with editing Stepping Stones and writing my articles on Nepal, not to mention giving tuition every day and dealing with correspondence, I was kept quite busy. In these circumstances, it was perhaps not surprising that the editorial which I contributed to the December Stepping Stones should have been the shortest I had so far written, or that it should have been entitled Pauses and Empty Spaces. Anything of the nature of a pause or empty space must have been rather welcome to me at this time, and it was no doubt with a certain amount of personal feeling that I wrote inter alia, quote, "A life which consists of a frantic stream of external activities, without one moment of inward recollection, is like music, which is an uninterrupted succession of sounds, or a picture which is crammed with figures. All three are not only meaningless, but positively painful." End quote. The other articles appearing in the December issue included the second instalment of Dr. Gunter's Our Position in Life, which, like the first one, was peppered with quotations from recondite tantric texts, both Sanskrit and Tibetan, and an unpretentious article entitled A Few Days in Sarnath by Sarojini Gunter. It may, in fact, have been at about this time that the Gunters paid their first visit to Kalimpong. Whenever it was, and it was probably during the Christmas holidays, Joe was at pains to make it clear that they were his guests and that he had no intention of sharing them with anybody, least of all with me, and I therefore saw very little of them. Indeed, I only saw them once, and then only for a few minutes, when we happened to meet on the road between the hermitage and the bazaar. This rather saddened me, for I would have gladly have heard more about the Vajrayana from the brilliant, if arrogant, Austrian scholar, who in any case was a regular contributor to Stepping Stones. Joe's attitude did not, however, surprise me, especially when I remembered how reluctant he had been for me to meet Dada Rinpoche. The truth of the matter was that the prickly Upasaka was not only taking less and less interest in the YMBA and in his duties as chairman of the activities committee, but was also trying to form a little circle of his own in Kalimpong. Nor was that all. He evidently wanted to keep his circle as distinct and separate as possible from what he chose to regard as my circle, and unfortunately could think of no better way of doing this than by disparaging me and the YMBA as much as he could, and discouraging people from having anything to do with us. It was as though he was afraid that if anybody strayed from his circle into my circle, they would straightaway become my friend rather than his, and henceforth think more highly of me than they did of him. Whatever the explanation of his shabby behaviour may have been, when I met the Gunters on the road between the Hermitage and the bazaar, they were noticeably less cordial than they had been in Lucknow, so that I had little doubt that Joe's vitriolic tongue had been at work with them too. Before the year was out, however, it had become obvious that what Joe was saying about me and the YMBA was by no means the biggest of my worries. Though the January 1952 issue of Stepping Stones appeared on time, it did not carry even a short editorial. For the first time in its history, there was no editorial article at all, and I had, therefore, no opportunity of striking, at the beginning of the issue, the unambiguously spiritual note which I had always intended should characterise the magazine's entire contents in varying degrees. In place of the editorial, there appeared an article bleakly headed An Appeal. The appeal was, of course, for funds. Since my return from Nepal, it had become more and more evident that, despite Stepping Stones' modest success, both in India and abroad, we were getting deeper into debt with every issue, and that it would be impossible for us to carry on without the help of our readers. In asking for that help, I took the opportunity of making it clear that the publication of Stepping Stones had been undertaken purely as an act of faith, that we had no wealthy backers, no permanent or regular sources of income, and that from the beginning of our existence, we had to depend on the donations of friends and sympathisers. Having made this clear, I proceeded to strike a more personal note, though still using the editorial first-person plural. Quote, seeing us continually occupied with the collecting of funds, frequently in debt, and, moreover, bearing the responsibility of running almost single-handed the various activities of the association, our friends sometimes wondered why we should give ourselves so much trouble, and even hinted that it would be better to discontinue the publication of a journal on which so much money was being spent with apparently so little result. But we never heeded their suggestions, for the motive with which the publication of Stepping Stones was begun, the fiery seed wherefrom it took its birth, was not the cheap desire that one more magazine might be added to the hundreds of literary and scholarly periodicals at present in circulation, but the lofty aspiration that the wisdom and compassion of all the Buddhas should be displayed before the eyes of beings as yet untouched by the beams of their glory. It was this thought which shed light on the darkest path we had to tread, which filled us with joy in the midst of difficulties. And when we reflected that our aspiration was in truth a no aspiration, and that there were in reality no beings to whom the wisdom and compassion might be displayed, then our joy knew no bounds, and we worked more vigorously than ever at the task to which we had set our hand. What some of our readers made of this divagation into the metaphysics of the Diamond Sutra in the middle of an appeal for funds, I do not know, but I wanted as many people as possible to realise the kind of spirit in which, from an unknown town in a remote part of the eastern Himalayas, the little yellow-covered magazine had been sent forth each month to the four corners of the earth. I wanted them to realise why it was so important that stepping stones should continue to appear. Immediately after my divagation into the metaphysics of the Diamond Sutra, however, I returned to the question of funds. We could no longer work unaided. If the publication of Stepping Stones was to be continued, it could only be with the assistance of some, at least, of those who felt that its continuation would be of value not only to themselves, but to all who prized the great treasure of Buddhist spirituality. Former sources of income, unreliable as they were, had in many cases been exhausted, and in others were no longer accessible. It was therefore imperative that new sources should not only be found, but found immediately. There were now no funds with which to meet the monthly printing bills, to say nothing of building up a permanent fund for the journal, or of increasing its size or improving the quality of the paper on which it was printed. It is for the bare existence of Stepping Stones that we are making this appeal, I therefore concluded. Those who wish to help us should do so by enrolling new annual subscribers and by sending us at once the most generous donation they can possibly afford. Having carried on the magazine for nearly 2 years without making any such appeal to our readers, in spite of the enormous difficulties which we have had to face, we feel that the cry for aid, which, in our present extremity, we are compelled to utter, will not go without prompt and generous response. As if to remind our readers of the kind of Buddhism for which Stepping Stones stood, and make clear the ultimate source of the spirit in which the magazine was conducted, the January issue also contained an article by Lama Govinda entitled Origins of the Bodhisattva Ideal, as well as the first instalment of my own Glimpses of Buddhist Nepal, a review of Dr. Konza's recently published Buddhism, Its Essence and Development by Dr. Gunter, and a translation of the famous episode from the Vimalakirti Nidesha, in which Vimalakirti, in response to Manjushri's inquiries about his health, says that he is sick because beings are sick, and that a bodhisattva's sickness is caused only by his great compassion. At the very beginning of his article, Lama Govinda pointed out that the bodhisattva ideal was inspired by the noble example of the Buddha's self-sacrificing career, for which reason he found it difficult to understand how such an ideal could arouse objections among those who professed to be followers of the Buddha. Yet some there were who looked upon the bodhisattva ideal as if it were either sheer foolishness or at most a dangerous heresy. The Sinhalese monk Kheminda Thera, for example, had written that with the acceptance of the bodhisattva ideal, quote, "The Mahayanists and those that think like them have dared to go beyond the words of the master. What the Buddha, the world knower, did not say, that is said and propagated by these people, and often in a fanatical way." These objections Lama Govinda met head-on. "Indeed," he retorted, "the followers of the bodhisattva ideal have dared to look beyond the pointing finger and have seen the brightness of the moon to which it pointed. Indeed, they have dared to follow not only the words, but the example of the master, which is a great deal more than quarrelling about theories and haggling over scriptures. It is also a great deal more courageous, because it certainly involves more risks than sitting comfortably upon the pedestal of one's own virtuousness, within the four walls of one's well-provided retreat, safely away from the polluting touch of the world." No doubt Kheminda Thera did not sit quite so comfortably on his pedestal after that. In the remainder of the article, which was written in the same trenchant style, Lama Govinda pointed out that one cannot help oneself without helping others, that the Buddhist virtues of selfless love, or maitri, and compassion, karuna, were not merely ratiocinations, but emotions which involved our whole being. That motive was more important than external consequences, and that the bodhisattva ideal, which enjoyed the greatest popularity in all Buddhist countries, was not a dividing but a uniting factor in Buddhist life and thought. Knowing that some copies of Stepping Stones took several weeks to reach their destination, I did not expect a uniformly speedy response to my appeal, and therefore brought out the February issue of the magazine as usual, even though I knew that this would sink us deeper in debt than ever, at least for the time being. This time the editorial, which was entitled An Old Saw Resharpened, was the longest I had written, and though the old saw in question was the one that charity begins at home, the article was in fact a vigorous attack on the spiritually disastrous habit of treating concepts as things in themselves, and therefore as ends in themselves. There was also the second and concluding instalment of Glimpses of Buddhist Nepal, while the news and notes section reported the holding of a highly successful ping-pong tournament, the finals of which had been played at the town hall under the presidency of the SDO, and the presentation of an alabaster Buddha image by a pious Burmese couple living in Akyab. The most important feature of the February issue was, however, the first instalment of Dr. Konza's Selected Sayings from the Perfection of Wisdom. Quote, roughly 25 Prajnaparamita sutras have been composed in India over a period of 900 years, Dr. Konza wrote in his brief introduction, from circa 100 BC to circa 800 AD. The texts vary greatly in length, but their total bulk is considerable. They are in the form of dialogues between Buddhas, bodhisattvas, and disciples. End of quote. Since the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras were among the profoundest and most important of all the Mahayana scriptures, and since only a fraction of them had been translated into English, I was overjoyed that Dr. Konza had entrusted the publication of his Selected Sayings to Stepping Stones, and looked forward to our bringing out an instalment of the work every month until it was complete. But this was not to be, and the remainder of Dr. Konza's Selected Sayings did not appear in print until the whole work was published in book form 4 years later. The February issue of Stepping Stones had not been out more than 2 or 3 weeks before it became obvious that my appeal was not meeting with the prompt and generous response for which I had hoped. In fact, it was meeting with no response at all, and that the February issue of Stepping Stones would be the last. It was a big setback and a great disappointment. In fact, it was the biggest setback the YMBA had so far received, and probably the greatest disappointment I myself had experienced since the day when, in obedience to Kashyapji's behest, I had really started working for the good of Buddhism. The second of the two beautiful and iridescent balls that, 20 months earlier, had been invited to descend was now floating away out of reach. Or rather, it lay shattered into 1,000 rainbow fragments on the earth, where it could no longer send out its brilliant flashes or be seen far afield. For a while I sought to piece some of those fragments together, trying to ensure the survival of Stepping Stones in a form which, though it might be less pleasing to the eye and less convenient to handle, we at least could afford to produce. Thanks to the generosity of Thubten Tenzin, I obtained a second-hand Gestetner duplicating machine from Calcutta, and at once set to work to bring out the March issue of Stepping Stones by this method, taking as my model the Golden Lotus, the beautifully duplicated Buddhist cum Theosophical magazine that we received each month from Philadelphia. But though typing the stencils was a simple enough matter, when it came to the actual business of printing, I encountered serious difficulties. Either the special semi-absorbent duplicating paper would not feed into the machine properly, or if it did, the sheets more often than not failed to take the ink evenly. After several weeks of work, I still had not succeeded in producing a single perfect copy of the March issue, let alone 1,000 copies, and my wretched attempts bore no resemblance whatever to the immaculate products of the Golden Lotus Press. In desperation, I therefore appealed for help to Joe, who I knew had had occasion to operate a Gestetner in his army days, when he had been in charge of the company office. Fortunately, the unpredictable Upasaka was in a comparatively mellow mood. He had, in fact, not crowed over me quite so much as I had expected when I told him about the difficulties Stepping Stones was facing, and actually spent 2 or 3 days at the Hermitage trying to get the Gestetner to work. But though he was, I suspected, not displeased to think that his headstrong and over-independent young friend could not get on without him, his efforts met with no greater success than mine had done, and in the end he gave up in disgust. This particular Gestetner was too much for him, he declared, inhaling the smoke of yet another cigarette and coughing violently. With our hands covered in ink, and with hundreds of sheets of duplicating paper we had spoiled lying on the floor around us, we therefore admitted defeat, and eventually, over a cup of tea, concluded that the probable cause of the trouble was that the machine was adapted to the temperature and humidity of the plains, not those of the hills. Whatever the cause might have been, looking from Joe's haggard face to the recalcitrant Gestetner, and from the recalcitrant Gestetner to Joe's haggard face, I realised that there was no hope of my bringing out a duplicated edition of Stepping Stones in Kalimpong, no hope of piecing any of the rainbow fragments together, and that the February issue of the little magazine, on which I had lavished so much thought and so much love, really would be the last to appear in any form. Long before that, however, I had to face the fact that the first of our two beautiful and iridescent balls was in danger of floating away like the second, or of lying in 1,000 rainbow fragments on the earth. Not only were there no funds with which to continue production of Stepping Stones, there were in reality no funds with which to continue running the Kalimpong YMBA. The annual Dusay collection brought in only 200 or 300 rupees, and the activities committee had never succeeded in contributing more than a fraction of the rent of the Hermitage, that is, of the main building, where the games room and the library and reading room were located, as distinct from the chalet at the other end of the garden where I lived. This meant that I had to subsidise the Kalimpong YMBA out of the donations I collected, and even, on occasion, out of my own scanty resources, which were at that time very scanty indeed, consisting as they did of the tuition fees of 1 or 2 relatively wealthy Tibetan pupils. YMBA members did not have to pay anything for tuition. The payments I received from the Illustrated Weekly of India for poems and from the Aryan Path for articles and book reviews, and the monthly allowance that I had been granted on Kashyapji's recommendation by Jugal Kishore Birla, the multi-millionaire Hindu philanthropist whose generosity had been responsible for the construction of Buddha Kuti, my teacher's residence on the campus of the Benares Hindu University. I had met Birlaji some years earlier when I was staying at Buddha Kuti with Kashyapji, and the meek and unassuming old man asked if there was anything he could do for me. No, I replied, there wasn't, since, thanks to the kindness of my teacher, I was already provided with everything I needed. Recollecting this exchange shortly after my removal from Burma Raja's guest cottage to the Hermitage, I had written to Kashyapji asking him to inform Birlaji that there was now something he could do for me, namely, help me financially. This Kashyapji had promptly done, adding that my work in Kalimpong was having the effect of counteracting the influence of the Christian missionaries, and Birlaji, who was the sworn foe of both Christianity and Islam, had at once given me a monthly allowance. It was for my dud makan, or milk and butter, the accompanying note explained. This allowance was to be my only regular source of income for nearly 2 years, and knowing that I would have to continue to subsidise the Kalimpong YMBA, which was in fact the only YMBA, our Ajma branch having affiliated itself to a Buddhist organisation in Delhi, as well as pay off our debts to the two presses. After the collapse of Stepping Stones, I therefore decided that there would have to be some drastic economies. My first economy was to give up the chalet. I was very sorry to do this. For the last 7 or 8 months, the greater part of my time had been spent inside the tiny wooden building, the exterior of which was already in need of a fresh coat of paint. There I had written and typed my articles and poems, edited Stepping Stones, and given individual tuition to some of my students. There, too, I had sometimes lain awake at night, listening to the sound of the bamboos in the Jura, only a few yards away, as the winds stirred their feathery tops and set their stems gently knocking one against the other. Normally I lived there alone, except for the company of Cleopatra, a stray tabby who had adopted us and who insisted on having her kittens on my bed. For a few weeks, however, I had shared my retreat with René Nebesky de Walkovich, the young Austrian ethnologist who had arrived in Kalimpong with Dr. Rock in 1950, and who had been a regular contributor to Stepping Stones almost from the beginning. Tall and fair-haired, and with a prominent beak of a nose, René was an exceptionally hard worker and pursued his ethnological and allied researches with indefatigable zeal. His principal interest was the oracles and demons of Tibet, material on all aspects of which he was collecting for a book. Much of this material consisted of the detailed descriptions of the demons, which he had copied out from a variety of Tibetan religious texts, many of them supplied by Dada Rinpoche. And I spent a number of evenings with him, helping him to improve the English of the translations of these descriptions, which were often extremely vivid. During the day, René was usually out. He was at that time working as Prince Peter's secretary, and immediately after breakfast used to set out on the long climb up to Krishna Lok, the house in Rinking Pong, to which the prince and princess had moved from Tashiding. Prince Peter, I gathered, was a very easy person to work for. Working for Princess Irene, however, was quite another matter. She was, in fact, an extremely difficult person to have anything to do with at all, and led poor René such a dog's life that he sometimes returned to the chalet in tears. When that happened, I used to talk to him until his composure was restored, and on such occasions he sometimes spoke more freely about himself than his aristocratic reserve usually permitted. Though Austrian by nationality, he was of Czech descent, his family having possessed a castle in Czechoslovakia, as well as extensive landed estates. With the coming of communism, they had lost everything, and for the first time in generations, had had to work for their living. He himself had not had an easy time getting through university, and he still had to help to support his mother. But though, as a result of his sufferings at the hands of Princess Irene, he sometimes opened up to me in this manner, René was by no means given to indulgence in either nostalgia or self-pity. A cheerful extrovert by nature, he was fond of the good things of life, and saw no point in denying himself such of them as were within his reach, especially when they took the form of an attractive and complacent Nepalese girl. His amorous escapades down at Seventh Mile were in fact notorious, and on one occasion, so my students told me, he had actually been stoned by a party of villagers who had caught him misbehaving with one of the local beauties in a maize field, and had had to flee for his life. The incident had taken place some time before he came to stay with me, and he naturally said nothing about it to me, or indeed about any of his amorous adventures, though he was not averse to hinting that he entertained a romantic passion for Kesang Dorji, the younger daughter of Raja and Rani Dorji. In any case, his exploits in the maize fields could not have occasioned the young ethnologist much uneasiness, for despite his strictly scientific interest in Tibetan Buddhism, he was a practicing Roman Catholic and on Sunday mornings generally went to confession and early mass at the Catholic mission, where presumably he unburdened himself of his sins and made his peace with his Maker. Be that as it may, with his cheerfulness and sociability and his keen interest in the life and culture of the area, René Nebesky de Rokovich was a very agreeable companion, and despite the Lilliputian dimensions of the chalet, I was glad to have him staying with me, the more especially since he was extremely scrupulous in money matters and always settled with me at the end of the week without demur or delay. Besides being an agreeable companion, René also acted as an intermediary between the world of the Hermitage and the socially more brilliant world of Krishnalok. And during the time that he was with me, I learned quite a lot about Prince Peter and Princess Irene, even as they no doubt must have learned quite a lot about me. Thus, I learned that Princess Irene's jewel box contained no fewer than 73 pieces of jewellery, including several magnificent tiaras, that she was an enthusiastic gardener, that she went for a walk with Dr. Roach every day, and that they talked Russian together, and that she was devoted to her pet squirrel Krishna, after whom the house had been named. I also learnt, in this case not by hearsay but by experience, that she was an excellent cook. From time to time, René brought back with him samples of dishes she had prepared, from which I concluded she had forgiven me for not eating the cake she had made with her own hands at the garden party nearly 2 years earlier. Indeed, from the time of René's stay with me at the chalet, the princess's dislike of me seemed to decrease, though it did not disappear entirely, until Krishna died and I wrote an epitaph for him, which she caused to be inscribed on his tomb. More interesting than what I learnt about the occupants of Krishnalok, however, was what I learnt about the occupants of Crookety. On my first visit to Dr. Roach, I had been conscious of a tremendous downward pressure, a pressure that was not physical but psychic, coming from the room overhead. René now informed me that this room was occupied by Madame Rurich, the Tibetologist's mother, and that the old lady was not only a theosophist, but a medium. Later on I discovered that she was in fact a spiritual medium, and that she had produced, in this capacity, a whole series of books that constituted the Bible, so to speak, of a small occult group within the wider theosophical movement. Dr. Rovich was very devoted to his mother, René added, so devoted indeed, that Princess Irene had once remarked of him that he had not yet been born. By the time I gave up the chalet, however, the flow of information between the Hermitage and Krishnalok had virtually ceased, René having left on an ethnological expedition to the Bhutanese border some time previously. For the last few months of my tenancy, I therefore had the place entirely to myself and was able to enjoy its peace and seclusion undisturbed, a circumstance for which I was sufficiently thankful when the time eventually came for me to move from the smaller to the larger building. Not that the latter was noisy, but only that it stood nearer to the road, and that living there I was, of course, more easily accessible to visitors, and had nowhere to escape to in the evenings if I wanted to be on my own. Yet, despite these drawbacks, the broken-down old bungalow was pleasant enough, and I soon settled down in my former room on the left of the games room, which was bigger and brighter than the corresponding room on the right, besides being further away from the smoke of the kitchen. From the curtainless front and side windows of this room, I could see a portion of the road below, as well as the foothills of Sikkim towering in the distance. And sitting at the rickety, gate-legged table, I would sometimes look up from my work to study the passers-by. This was especially the case when it happened to be raining heavily and I had no visitors, and when in any case I was in a reflective mood.
apart from the loudly chattering boys and girls on their way to and from school. Most of the people who passed the bottom of the track leading up to my front gate. Actually, there was no gate, but only two mildewed posts, were peasants and coolies bound for the bazaar. And many of these, women and bare-legged men alike, carried on their backs the traditional cone-shaped bamboo basket. On Wednesdays and Saturdays, which were market days in Kalimpong, they would pass by earlier than usual and in greater numbers, and their baskets would be heavily laden with charcoal, vegetables and grain. Some of them would have chickens dangling head downwards from their wrists, legs tied together and wings feebly flapping, while others would be driving before them two or three protesting goats, or even a whole herd of buffaloes. Whatever it was that they were taking to market, I knew that they were taking it with the intention of selling it for the best price they could get, and with the proceeds buying such things as paraffin, cooking oil and matches, which they could not produce themselves. Clothes were, of course, bought only once a year at the time of the autumn pujas. I also knew that regardless of what price they succeeded in getting, some of them were sure to end up spending a good part of the money in the liquor shops, with the result that the next time they passed by on their way home, they would be shouting incoherently and staggering from one side of the road to the other.
But even though most of the people who passed by the bottom of the track that led up to my front gate were peasants and coolies, this does not mean that those who did not fall into this category were not sufficiently varied in type. On looking up from my work, I might see a Tibetan official in dark-coloured chuba and homburg out for a morning stroll, though most Tibetans lived at 10th mile and were rarely seen in the vicinity of 8th mile or 9th mile. Or I might see a well-to-do Sikkimese nurseryman from 7th mile hastening to the bank, or a Muslim roti-walla, or bread man, on his rounds, staff in hand and tin box balanced on turbaned head. Or a white-shirted Bihari barber making his way to the house of a regular customer. Or I might even see a priest from the Roman Catholic mission, or a pair of nuns. The priest would be wearing a white tropical soutane and would generally have his nose in his breviary, while the nuns, whose habits were either black or blue in colour, would keep their heads well down and hurry past the hermitage, as though conscious that the place contained something or someone inimical to their faith. When tired of sitting at the rickety table, I sometimes walked up and down the path that ran between the hermitage and the octagonal shrine room, as I had often done when living in the chalet. This path divided the garden into two unequal parts, in the more extensive of which, the one that lay further back from the road, stood the majority of the ornamental trees that had been planted by the original owner of the property. With the exception of the 40-foot eucalyptus standing immediately opposite the front door of the hermitage, the biggest of these trees were the magnolia and the tulip tree, both of which were now perfect specimens of their kind, as were most of the smaller trees by which they were surrounded. Since not all the trees bloomed at the same time of year, there was always a gleam of colour to be seen among the branches, apart from the glossy green of the leaves. At one time it might be the cream colour of the enormous globe-shaped magnolia blossoms, at another the mingled pink and white of the tulip tree's upward-pointing blossoms, conspicuous on their leafless branches. At yet another, the deep red of the camellias or velvety white of the gardenias. As well as the blooms of the ornamental trees, there were those of the bamboo orchids and ginger lilies, which grew in clumps at the foot of the bank to the rear of the garden. Though the former were partly pink and partly cerise, while the latter were wholly white, both looked more like butterflies than flowers, and one half expected them to fly away. Yet whether the gleams of colour among the branches were many or few, as I slowly walked up and down the path, which sometimes was bordered with shocking pink zinnias and bright orange marigolds, I nearly always experienced a deep sense of peace and harmony, of fulfilment and well-being. It was as though the trees were my silent companions, companions who could share my thoughts and feelings, and from whose tranquil presence I derived nourishment and inspiration. Indeed, as I walked up and down in their leafy neighbourhood, sentences of articles and stanzas of poems would come unbidden into my mind, as well as feelings and insights for which I had as yet no words. When that happened, I would experience an intense joy. The flowers above my head and at my feet would shine with an unearthly radiance, and to me it would seem that the garden of the Hermitage was a veritable Garden of Eden. The Adam and Eve of this Eden lived in a cabin near the front gate, halfway between the gate and the road. The official designation of the masculine and superior component of the Aboriginal syzygy was Marley, or gardener, literally garland man, the original function of the Indian gardener being to grow flowers for garlands. But neither he nor his wife ever did any gardening, except for occasionally sweeping up the dead leaves and growing a few vegetables for themselves. On the contrary, the so-called Marley spent most of his time in town, working in a liquor shop, from which he would return at the end of the day with bloodshot eyes and uncertain step, the owner of the shop no doubt having found it more convenient to pay him in liquor than in cash. A Tamang, and therefore a Buddhist by birth, as was his wife, he was an unkempt little man who always wore the same torn and filthy Nepalese costume, with a kukuri, or Gurkha knife, thrust into the cummerbund. His most striking feature, however, was his hair, which, having been cropped a couple of years earlier, now stuck out in all directions like the quills of a porcupine. Drunk or sober, and he was hardly ever sober, his face habitually wore an expression of sullen and stupid rage, a rage that, only too often, found an outlet in beating his wife, a fair-skinned, handsome woman nearly twice his size, who apparently never attempted to retaliate, as some Nepalese woman would have done. They had been married only a year or two, and their first child was born shortly after I had moved from the chalet to the main building. On looking out of my window on the day after the delivery, which, of course, had taken place in the cabin, I saw the Marlini, or gardener woman, as she was generally called, standing alone in the middle of their little vegetable patch. She was paler than usual, and in her eyes there was the blank, uncomprehending look of an animal. Where Adam and Eve dwell, there Lilith will also be found, if not in the Garden of Eden itself, then certainly not very far away. On the terraced hillside above the Hermitage, but out of sight, there stood a wattland daub hut, and in the hut lived a Nepalese woman and her three or four small children. Who the woman was and what had happened to her menfolk, nobody seemed to know, any more than they knew how she managed to support herself and her brood. She was, in fact, something of a mystery, particularly as she spent most of her time either in the hut or on her own terrace, and was hardly ever seen elsewhere. But if she was not seen, she was certainly heard, especially on the night of the new moon. On that night, I would be woken up by a kind of frenzied chant coming from further up the hillside. What the words of the chant were, I could not tell, but the woman shrieked them out at the top of her voice, and with all the strength of her lungs, as though her very life depended on it. Over and over again she shrieked them out, hardly pausing for breath, the feebler, shriller voices of the children sometimes accompanying her. Was she calling back a husband or lover, or invoking a demon, or exorcising the spirits of disease? I did not know. Whatever she was doing, she kept up the performance all night, and when dawn came, her chanting was no less loud and no less frantic than it had been 7 or 8 hours earlier. Though the mysterious woman woke me up with her chanting once a month, Her hut was situated several dozen yards away, and at other times she did not disturb me. The chalet stood a little nearer to the hermitage than that, besides being situated on the same level, and knowing that my joint landlords would not allow the place to remain empty, I naturally wondered who the new tenants would be, and how great a disturbance their presence at the other end of the garden would constitute. One afternoon it seemed as though my worst fears might be realised. Hearing voices outside, I looked up from my work in time to see, passing in front of the building, the burly figure of one of the drivers who worked for my landlord's motor transport service. He was followed by his wife, his wife's sister, his mother, a servant girl, and an indeterminate number of children. There was even a baby asleep in the arms of one of the women. On going out onto the veranda and looking in the direction of the garden after the retreating figures, I saw them mount the steps of the chalet and, one by one, disappear inside. How they all managed to get in and how they ever found room for all the boxes and bundles they had brought with them, I was unable to imagine. But get in they did, and were still living there when, 2 years later, I myself had to leave the hermitage. Since they found it convenient to make a footpath from the back of the chalet down to the road, I saw and heard very little of them, and it was only during the final months of my stay there that they gave me any cause for complaint. End of chapter 15.